This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about mental health nursing with a very exciting guest we'll talk about shortly. First off, I've got a definition from Wikipedia. Psychiatric nursing or mental health nursing is the appointed position of a nurse that specialises in mental health.
Absolutely. I speak about... Sorry. Do you know why? Because as soon as I said absolutely, I thought, do you know what, Dan? I reckon every week on the podcast, you start by saying absolutely because Bob opens up with like a great statement or a definition. And then I say, absolutely. But yeah, the more I've thought about it, really, they also will be the ones that their ears are constantly open and listening to patients talk about how they feel being on the ward or whatever it is they're going through, especially during this pandemic.
Right. And that's part of the reason I was so glad to get to look at it today, because the NHS is being affected by this pandemic. But I think there's areas where sometimes the links can't be as direct, you know, so our guest is talking about different environments, some environments that are directly involved in COVID, some which aren't for COVID treatment, but maybe there's some diagnosis in there. But equally, you know, there are mental health units that, because of some of them being so secure as part of their function, have been very successful in keeping out the virus. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're not under more pressure. You know, they're still having to ramp up their hygiene and the protective things for the patients. They're having to be secure in a whole different, you know, environmental way, as well as the physical side of security. So I think it's one of these things that the pandemic, it reaches everyone. If you're in healthcare, you will be affected by this. And it was really interesting then to hear our guests talk about different environments and how that's played out.
Yeah, right. And going from working in an adolescent psychiatric unit to then going on to a COVID ward, completely different type of nursing and completely different impact on their own mental health, physical health, everything.
Yeah. And as we've seen in so many shocking statistics recently, that impact is massive. So one recently reported by the BBC was that up to 50% of those dealing directly with COVID in their medical role are experiencing symptoms of PTSD. So maybe it's not to the extent where they're diagnosable, but that huge concern, up to 50%, is massive. And you do worry, when we're at such a precarious time with the cases being so high, how much more our wonderful frontline workers can cope with.
I know that's been the most shocking thing to me this past month, really. I think January's really hit that home, because we're seeing images all the time of and interviews of our frontline workers being obviously highly stressed on wards, speaking to camera. And as you said, the BBC are reporting there are some signs of PTSD potentially, but we're still in the throes of it. And they're so amazing that they'll rise above whatever's going on to help and care for those that are coming in. When we get to the end of this, and when people have got a chance to actually stop and breathe, even non-frontline workers, I think it will hit people, and people are trying to keep it all together at the moment, and especially doctors and nurses or anybody that works, you know, in healthcare, trying to keep it together because they feel that there's no other option, because if they don't, who's there to help? Our people and our society. And so, yeah, if we're starting to see signs now, I wonder what it's going to be like, you know, like down the line. And that has been quite troubling. And, you know, looking at some of the research, there's so little work that's been done on the mental health of mental health practitioners, you know, who is looking after them.
The irony. You know, who's looking
after them. Yeah, the irony. Yeah.
But we see it all the time, and it's this expectation that the people that are in caring roles have to hold everybody else up. And I think that pressure is very much felt. So we've got one stat from Mind that says 9 in 10 nurses are feeling more stressed and anxious than usual. I doubt will surprise anybody, that statistic. And then one that was even higher than I would imagine, from nursingpractice.com, highlighted data that in April, so still fairly early on in this pandemic, over 250,000 full-time nursing days were lost to COVID-19 related sickness, or self-isolation. So that's 37% of all the absences. Yeah. Or to put it another way, a 50% increase in the usual absences.
Yeah, that is crazy. And you know what, Bob? I was going to say this to you the other day. A friend of mine who is a nurse has had COVID. So she's been isolating. Her children and her partner have also been tested positive. So they've all been isolating together. But she was like, Dan, I'm counting down the days. Get me out of this house. Okay. I want to go back to work. But she's like, I know that my team need me. You know, they know who's off once. You know, there's always somebody off with COVID in her team. So she's like, they need me at work. And to be honest, I need work. So imagine even that made me think about how we're coping the pressure pot in a household where you've got children and a partner and you're all there together for days who you can't even now go for a walk. So for us, she's telling me you're privileged, Dan, because you go for a walk every day with the kids. We can't even do that. So we've been in for 14 days or 10 without going out, can't even go shopping. So we've had food parcels and things dropped off, like family members bringing food for them and stuff. And I thought, wow. And that pressure felt so real for her, that she was actually looking forward to going back to work as a nurse during COVID.
Yeah. Maybe there's some contrast with our guests then, because our wonderful guests, we should say who they are. So if you've been watching season 2 of Drag Race UK on the BBC, and you've seen that one of the queens is also a mental health nurse and thought they need to be on a certain podcast, well, we are delivering. So we have Cherry Valentine here, and we got to speak to her just a few days after the first episode went out. And that was really interesting to hear, you know, that experience of being part of something where the filming was interrupted by COVID. So, you know, originally the filming started some time ago, and then looking back and not knowing what's going to make the edit and how anxiety inducing that can be alone. And you're suddenly becoming more famous in a time where you can't go meet your public. You can't go on tour. Yeah. That was all fascinating. And of course, hearing about the experience of being a mental health nurse through this. Such an altruism.
Yeah.
To be like, all
great
of this
word.
Is going on for me. We're in the pandemic. It's horrible. I feel I have to step up. And I know so many medical professionals are thinking the same thing. And it's, yeah, so admirable.
So admirable. And you know, it's just amazing to see how well they coped or have taken all that on. Because like you said, the anxiety inducing bit for anybody on any show, or even for us on a podcast, you know, when it's edited, to see how, you know, what you're going to sound like. And we have control of
we
our
get
edit,
to edit so it. Yeah. Very grateful for that.
Absolutely. Cherry's got no control, and you sat there watching it. And like you said, in previous shows, they were, you know, as if drag queens haven't got enough to contend with in the world of hate and love after putting yourself out there on a national TV show or that will be shown globally, you know, deal with that on your own, isolated, at home. There's a whole load of stuff going on. So I just think, oh, fair play. We just loved this guest. And you know what struck me was the resilience. I just thought, we're all so resilient. We can get through this. We're managing it in some ways. And as much as I thought, being a mental health nurse must be so hard to then come away from that and get dressed up and perform. As Cherry said, you know, it's their outlet.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's something that you then want to do, you know, and feel that you can remove yourself from reality.
Yeah, get a bit of fun, you know, because that's what it is. You know, that's why, particularly in the UK, drag incorporates so many elements like comedy, like song, like dance. You know, it's a joyous combination. Not to mention all the fun outfits that we're already getting to
love
see some
the
of.
Outfits. Oh, the costumes are amazing.
At a time when we need some hope and we need some fun.
Absolutely. I love how RuPaul said at the beginning of the first episode, we did so well in the last one, you Brits, you wanted us back. And I thought, yeah, we sure did. So here we are. I thought, wow, here you are, full of colour and exuberance and fun and vitality at a time when the world just needs it more than ever. So
yeah, please enjoy this episode with Cherry Valentine. But first,
who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hello, my name is Cherry Valentine, also known as Georgie, out of drag, and I'm a mental health nurse, a drag queen. So when I was growing up, mental health wasn't something that we really spoke about in my family. I think that was because Well, everyone really had traditional values, and it was sort of a case of the men were the men and the women were the women, and men don't talk about the feelings and women only talk about the feelings with other women. So it was very restrictive growing up in that sense, because I didn't really know what mental health was, to be honest. I just thought we are who we are and we just get on with it. But I think growing up, it was always like in the back of my mind, like something's different here. Like, why can't I speak to anyone and why doesn't anyone want to talk about anything? Because it was always very face value stuff, like, oh, what are you having for tea? Or, oh, have you heard about blah, blah, gossiping? And I'm not interested in that. So, I mean, to cut a long, long story short, I was the only out gay kid in school between my close friends and stuff. And they were asking me, like, questions that I'd never really heard of, like, oh, so how do you feel? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I was like, God, yeah, I've got my own opinions. And as I grew up, I realised that I was sort of separating who I was into, like, my personality at home, and then my personality around people who I was closer with outside of the family. I was very aware of it. So it was a strange time in my life. It was just a case of, like, I would make up little lies and things about, oh, I've got a girlfriend, and then I'd actually be going to meet a boy. Yeah, there's lots of things that went on that made me feel like I wasn't really living my authentic self for a long, long time.
And do you feel like it was partly the community you came from, that it was that restrictive with the idea of who you should be?
I think so, because even over this year, I've learned a lot about myself and I've learned a lot about my own gender and who I am, like my own sexuality and everything. And I think that's because we've had so much time to like really focus in on ourselves. And I've really been away from the family the past few years. And I think that's allowed me to grow as a person and mentally, and especially working in mental health as well. It's just made me realise how really complicated and how in-depth the mental psyche is and like who we are as people. But I think a big part of a lot of the struggles and a lot of the mental breaks that I've had growing up was due to my upbringing.
Just trying to prompt you there as well to, if you don't mind sharing a bit about like coming from a gypsy community.
Yeah, so the gypsy community, and it's exactly what it is. Like, it's a community in itself. I mean, we used to travel around a little bit, and then we settled down when my brother was born because we couldn't live in a trailer anymore because it was too small. So we needed somewhere to like settle, and my parents wanted to settle into a house. So we moved into a house, and it was a whole different life for them as well, I think, because they'd never really done it. But the gypsy community is very closed, and everyone knows everyone's business. It's a case of, everyone's heard the saying of what happens behind closed doors, but I guess in this sense, it's like what happens behind closed community doors. I don't know, like everyone, yeah, it's like you've got your small family, you've got your parents, you've got your brothers and sisters, but then you've got the wider family, which sometimes you don't really speak to. But in the travelling community, we all speak to each other all the time, and it can get like a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I see that. And I think there's that additional pressure then, because it's so close-knit, there's more pressure on how you come across, how you represent your family. So maybe for you, you felt like the elements of, okay, I have to be this specific idea of a person, and then the consequence if I don't is all these people could shun me.
Yeah, exactly. And it is old-fashioned in the view of, because I was the first born male in my family, there was always that pressure. It was like, I need to get married as soon as possible. I need to start my own family. I need to be a man. And I need to fall into that role. Whereas that was never who I felt like I should have been, because we used to go to like weddings and parties and stuff all the time. And the men would always sit in the corner drinking beer, talking about cars and things like that. And then the women would all be like dancing and stuff. And I wanted to be up there dancing and like talking about fashion and clothes and all this fabulous stuff. But I was never allowed. There was always that pressure of, I have to follow in what my dad did. I have to take over his business and like go down that road and get married and have kids.
It's a lot of pressure. Was there also, I'm more familiar with the Irish gypsy community specifically, but was there that similar time pressure as well of getting married younger than maybe the average more broadly?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even my sister, she's, I can't remember how old she is now, I've not spoken to her in years, but she was about 18. And I remember a conversation my mum was having with her saying, have you not thought about getting married yet? You're getting a bit old. And I thought, 18 to get married is that old? I know that now, but at the time I was like, oh yeah, she should be married by now, but it's mad.
Well, that's it. And that was so much of the context. And then you're going to school with a broader section of the society and you're realising how much of your experience is very specific. And at the same time, you've got sexuality stuff coming along. And so was that when you were starting to see mental health symptoms come along?
I mean, I guess so, yeah. Because I really felt like I was, like I said before, like a split person. So when I came home and I would actually like start and try and have conversations with my family saying, I think I might like boys. Like I had a conversation with my mum when I was about 14 and she was like, I've known for years, but we can't tell anyone about it. We can't talk about it. And because I'm really scared that you're not going to be able to have kids and you're not going to like, you're going to bring shame to the family and all this stuff. And I think that's so much pressure to have as a young person. And then to go to like school where I was actually the only out gay kid and I still had the eyes on me there like, oh God, he's gay. But it wasn't like the sense of you're going to bring shame. It was more like a novelty. So it was really weird growing. I didn't really experience another gay person until I was like in college.
Wow. School environment, whilst it may have been more accepting in some ways, it's also a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because I didn't know how to act. I didn't know how someone should act in my position. Like it was always a case of when I was growing up, my mum always said, and my dad supported her in saying, I wouldn't like go to college. I wouldn't go to university. I'm just going to finish school when I'm 16 and do my dad's business. And that's what happened with the women in my family. If they went to school, they would only do it till they were about 16. Then they got pulled out to just stay home and do housework and stuff. And it's so old-fashioned and it's so crazy looking back, but that's how it was. And it is still is like that in some places.
And that's the context that you knew. So that was your whole world. And only by seeing other people's, you got that comparison.
Yeah, I mean, people started asking me about how I felt. And I was really like withdrawn at school. I used to like really be by myself and not really talk to anyone for a long, long time. And one of my teachers approached me and said, do you want to speak to the counsellor? And I was like, okay, I'll give it a go and see what I can do. I sat with a counsellor, I remember, in school, and I just cried the whole session. I didn't say anything. And it was like a good hour that I just cried. And I'd never cried because I was always told that you should cry. Like, you're a man, you don't need to, like, don't cry. But yeah, I just cried the whole way through. And then that was the last time I really showed emotion for a couple of years. It was sort of like a build-up. I let it all out and then I just bottled it all up again. And it's only recently now that I'm actually starting to talk about my feelings. But I'd never really, like I said, I never really knew what mental health was. I just thought it was, everyone was just going through their own stuff. So I'd never thought, like, I don't know. Even now, like being a mental health nurse, I think we always have our own experiences and things. And like what we said before, I don't agree with putting people in boxes at all because we're all different. Like one person with a depression is completely different to another person with depression. And I never really got that because I didn't know what it was when I was younger.
Yeah, and it sounds very overwhelming the way you describe it, because then your first experience of dealing with a mental health professional is you crying for an hour, something that you didn't feel comfortable with. So of course you're like, oh shit, this is scary. I'm going to go back to withdrawing into myself.
Yeah, and I guess that's what it did. Yeah, I guess, I think it's just a case of just trying to get through it however way you can. And it's sort of like you're fighting for stuff that you don't even know what you're fighting for when you're growing up. You just try to win a battle that you don't even know is going to be able to be won.
It's a lot of guesswork. It's like, how do any of us decide what we want to do with our lives? All the adults are constantly asking us, and you're like, I don't know, I like drama class, I guess, a drama-ista. I don't know. You know, we actually know nothing. And, yeah, you know, clearly you'd found something where you're like, okay, I connect with this stuff. It's interesting, but scary. And so when did you kind of then start to understand mental health a bit better and then see it as potentially a career?
Well, I was really adamant that I wanted to do something with my education. So I didn't want to just do my dad's job. So I approached my mum because she was the one who I could speak to the most about school and stuff. And I said, I really want to go to college. I really want to go to university. I want to do something. I want to get a good job. And I don't just want to do what my dad's doing. And she was like, well, go to college, but what do you want to do? Do you want to do something really good? I think you should be a doctor. So it was that whole thing of like, if you're going to do it, you need to do it like this. So then my parents got it into head that I was going to be a doctor. And I applied for college and I was like, I don't want to be a doctor because I really like listening to people. And I don't really think doctors always can do that. They're not always able to. So that's why I went to apply as a mental health nurse, because at school we did educational fair and they were telling us about what mental health nurses do, and I thought that's really cool. I can actually try and help someone and hopefully like not feel the same as I'm feeling, which is really weird to think like back because I was only young, so I don't know what I was thinking. But
it's empathy, that's what was growing. You were like, I'm really struggling with this, I know that it's a big deal and that a lot of people struggle with it, and so therefore I can appreciate how big the need is, and maybe yeah. I'm the person that helps others.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think that's lovely. Yeah. I don't think that's weird. I think that sounds lovely.
Yes, I just went to college and I started nursing, and that's where, well, I didn't start nursing at college. I went to college and then I did psychology, and I'd always had a fascination with art and fashion. So I did textiles as well secretly. My parents didn't know that I did that. So I just really focused on, oh, I do psychology and I'm doing English. These are going to help me be a doctor, don't worry. But really, I'm doing like fine art and textiles and everything as well on the side. But yeah, and then I just did that. And then it came to the end of college, I applied to be a mental health nurse. And then I got in, and through college doing psychology, I think that's what really opened my mind to what mental health was and how it really affects people. Because we were doing case studies about mental illness and how it affects people's lives and how upbringings affect people. And I really did resonate with it.
Was there that moment of, oh shit, this is a bit too familiar at any point?
Yeah, it was very, very familiar. But I'd still never talk about it with anyone. I'd be like, oh yeah. I was very like objective when it came to things. And it was all that, like, I was still holding everything in of myself, my own mind. I knew what it was talking about, but I didn't want to accept that I related to it. Yeah, so that
was... I get that. And I think we're very much encouraged to do that as men. We are more encouraged to try and approach the world in a very kind of logical and linear way. And, you know, we focus on our careers and our progression and expectations of the family and the other stuff, the emotional side. We are encouraged to box it up. So your experience was quite specific to you. I think all men, to an extent, experience that pressure to kind of compartmentalize our lives and have different versions. Because if the idea of what it is to be a big, strong man is so narrow, then it's like we can't possibly be fully ourselves in any situation. Yeah. We choose bits.
Definitely, without a doubt. And I think that's another thing that I really struggled to come to terms with, because I didn't always feel like a man. Do you know what I mean? So it was like a case of, I should be doing all this stuff and I know why I should be doing all this stuff, but I don't want to do it because I don't relate to that, you know?
And I think there can be that element of you feel like you'd fail at it anyway. So it's like, maybe I won't bother. Whereas you were finding spaces, you were finding possibly women in your life that you looked up to and seeing that I can relate to certain things with them. You were finding the textiles work and you were like, oh, there are all these safe spaces where I don't have to just be one narrow idea of myself.
Yeah. Looking back, I have no idea why I hate doing stuff like art and textiles, because they're literally just subjects. Anyone can do them. I hate gender stereotypes. Like, I don't like walking into a shop and seeing male and female clothing, because it's just clothing. If you want to wear something, wear it.
Yeah, well, our bodies are far more similar than they're different anyway.
Yeah, exactly. This whole, like, male, female, I just think it's everyone's just people and we all have our experiences.
Yeah, we have a tricky time sometimes talking about gender on the podcast, because we're aware that there are differences, but those differences are most of the time socialised as opposed to real. Like, there's some other reason why they're reality.
Yeah, exactly, and it helps society.
And we might come back to that when we talk drag in a little bit, but to fast forward to, you know, then you've done your work, you're getting into mental health nursing. And so how did you find that then, going into working with patients and building your career?
When I first started nursing, it was a bit of like a culture shock, because I didn't realise that some people were really, really struggling. It's different one thing talking about it in class, seeing things on TV and reading up on case studies. But when you're actually faced with someone sat in front of you, like telling you things that have really affected them and changed their lives, and they're thinking about suicide and all these really hard hitting stuff, it's like, wow, the world is much more complicated than I even thought it was going to be. So starting in that mental health field really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I'm really glad for it, though, because I think it's really educated me in the sense of the world we live in.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, that insight into people's lives behind the scene, because the stigma means that so much of it is hidden. So you possibly have an idea of human struggle that a lot of people just don't have access to, people that are struggling to that extent because they are in hospital or other facilities. And, you know, it means that a lot of us don't realise how bad things can get until we're in that position.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, as if your profession isn't already difficult enough, then the pandemic comes along. So what did that change?
So before the pandemic, I worked for a couple of years in PQ. So it's like psychiatric intensive care. And I was working with adolescents. So the 12 to 18 year olds, these like kids and young adults who've been like sectioned. And it was really intense, but it was very, very mental health focused. The only times that I really got involved physically was like if I was like dressing self-harm wounds and things like that. But then I finished doing that to obviously go on Drag Race, because I had this thing going on in the background as well. Started filming Drag Race had to stop because of the pandemic. And then I was sat at home thinking, I've literally got like, I'm a nurse. Like, I can't just sit at home and do nothing while there's a worldwide pandemic going on. So I took up nursing again. And when I went back into it, it was very, very intense because it wasn't just mental health focused anymore. It was very physical focused. And I was working on the agency sometimes, and I was going into A&Es, and I was going into high intensity units where people were on ventilators and things. And I was seeing people die from COVID. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is like a completely different new world to me. But it's really interesting how mental health and physical health literally interlink so much. And like, one of the things that really affected me during the pandemic was the fact that when people were dying and they were in that position, they couldn't always see people who were very close to them. Like, they couldn't see the families. And it was all like this. It was all over Zoom and all over Skype and things. And I've always been a big believer in human connection. And that really affected me about the pandemic, I think, looking back. But it just changed the whole landscape of what nursing was for me.
It's an interesting point, because we might not realise, if we're outside of the medical community, how shielded even you guys can be from that interlinking of mental and physical health, because so many of the professions are a specialism on predominantly one side or the other. And so it almost takes something like this pandemic, which is so all-encompassing, to be like, oh yeah, this all links together, not just in that setting, but I think we're all having a reminder of our mental health is massive. And so many people, we're staying inside because of concerns for physical health, but it's our mental health struggling.
Yeah. And hopefully we're seeing some end of it very soon.
says a very tired nurse.
Yeah, I mean, I did stop doing nursing like 2 weeks before we started filming again. Mm-hmm. You have to quarantine and stuff before you go back. And then I've got an interview this week to start it up again, because obviously nothing's open at the minute. So
wow,
it's so like back and forth, what you can do at the time.
Yeah, it's very on and off. And of course, now you're into a situation where it's even more intense, even in the last few weeks. So How do you feel about going back to it?
I feel like I need to, because I hate just staying at home and doing nothing. I like being proactive. And I'm going to work more in the vaccination centres. So hopefully an extra pair of hands can speed it up to get back to some form of normality again. But I don't think I would be mentally prepared to go back into what I was doing the first time round, because it was very, very tough.
And how were you finding that was affecting you day to day?
It wore me out mentally and physically. I would come back from a long shift, and the only thing that would pick me up a little bit is getting into drag, weirdly enough. So I would like fully desanitize my whole body and just get into drag and just pretend that everything's fine in the world. Sort of like an escapism, I guess.
No, I really see that, because it's just so different, and it's a level of transformation that most people don't have. You know, you can have that and then look in the mirror and not even recognise the tired nurse that finished work a few hours ago.
Yeah, exactly. And drag's something that makes me feel like it like steps out of my own body. Because when I look in the mirror, like me sometimes, I don't always see myself. And when I'm in drag, I just feel more, I know who I am. Do you know what I mean? It's really difficult to explain.
I think I know what you mean, because sometimes it can be easier to own a version of ourselves that we've created. So like, I interview a lot of comedians, and they sometimes say that to me, that they feel the most themselves on stage, because that's where they feel comfortable, they know what to say, and then they come out to the real world and they're like, oh, people expect me to be funny all the time and I don't have a script anymore.
Yeah, and it is like what you said, it is that sense of control. It's a part of your personality that you're able to control, and no one can really tell you what's right and wrong about it. It's just something that you've brought into the world.
And do you feel, I know a lot of people talk about with drag, it makes them feel stronger. Do you feel that extends to mental health for you? Do you feel more resilient with the kind of mental cue of the costume and the authority that you might gain?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't see it in the sense of authority, but when I'm in drag, I do feel more able to not really listen to negative things or like people's perceptions. Mm-hmm. If I was walking down the street and someone was like, I've had it before where someone's like spat in my face and called me a faggot and all these horrible things, and that really affects you as a person. But when I'm in drag and someone says, oh, you look like tranny, I hate the word, but It doesn't affect me. It just goes straight over my head. But if I was out of drag, that would probably really affect me.
With that situation you described of the assault, what was the context? Was that somebody you knew? Was it just random?
It was during school, because I was obviously the only out gay kid at school, like I said. And not everyone was accepting of that. So I would like walk through the park with my friends, and then there'd be like a bunch of lads who would come up to us and start calling me all sorts of names and spit in my face. And yeah, it wasn't nice, but that's one of many, many scenarios that I've been through. But again, I look back and think I'm a stronger person maybe for it. I don't know.
I'm sure you are. I mean, you know, you're surviving things that most people don't have to live through. That it can be such a part of the queer experience, that outsiderism. And I wonder, with then creating Cherry, if that almost feels like a fresh canvas because she's not gone through those things.
Yeah, probably. Because it is, it does feel like a different person to me. I know a lot of the other queens just see themselves as the same in and out of drag, and it's just like a heightened version of their personality. But when I'm in drag, I just feel like a different person. So it's interesting to see how different people take to it.
Mm. And do you feel like that comes the other way? So do you feel like as your confidence has grown in drag, you've brought confidence and other features into the rest of your life?
Yeah, and I think a big part of that was going on Drag Race. And I know it's just a TV show to a lot of people, but it has really changed my perception on a lot of things. And not just because of what RuPaul says to everyone, or not because of the position that you're in. I just think because of the conversations that some of the conversations that it does prompt, it really does make you think. And it's different when you are trying to explain something, but you know the whole world's going to see it. So it makes you think, like, what do I actually think of myself, and what do I want people to think of me?
Yeah. And then also you've got the element of, in that you're appearing in and out of drag. So was that challenging?
Yeah, without a doubt, because it's sort of like confusing the two then. It's sort of like making them the same thing, whereas actually to me they're completely different. Because if I was in like the interviews as Cherry, I would probably say some completely different things that I would do as me.
And it's interesting that for all that it's a drag competition and it's a very specific part of the queer experience, it does feel, like you say, with the conversations that come up, very all-encompassing. And I wonder if that's part of the reason it's coming in and out of it. So, you know, we saw in the first episode, one of your fellow queens got really worried about taking off their makeup. And it was like, you know, that was maybe a barrier that protects them. And almost... Yeah. By going in and out of drag, there's maybe like every layer of you gets exposed. And maybe that's part of why so many conversations come up.
Yeah, I think so. And that conversation in particular, we actually had like a full conversation and it went on for ages. But obviously they can only crop it down to so much to show on TV, and they need to keep it lighthearted and everything sometimes. But there was some really big conversations that were had, like long conversations about things, which I think would probably be interesting for people to hear, but maybe in a different forum. It is a reality TV show and it should be all heightened and everything. But people, I think it's important to remember that that is what people see, is really only a 5-minute snapshot in our lives. And it's not really who we are fully, because we're on TV and people sometimes act different on TV and try and be something that they're not always. It's definitely changed my perception on a lot of things.
The experience obviously was so distinct in having this through the pandemic. And even now you're watching it at a time where in seasons gone by, queens would, you know, host shows and they would be out watching it with the public. But instead, you're watching it more isolated. How have you found that whole experience?
It has been exactly that. It's been very isolated. It's such a different feeling, because I remember watching it last year and seeing everyone go out and tour and do all these things and meet all these people and share all these stories. But now, because it's in the middle of a pandemic, we've got the whole world up in chaos, and this show's come out, and I think people are a lot more aware of it because we've got really not much else to do than see what's on TV and like discover more about ourselves. So I've literally had thousands of messages on like Instagram and Twitter about people telling me their stories and like how it's supportive and how it's like crazy and amazing. And that always does come with the hate, obviously. But I try not to think about that. I block it out. But it has been a really different experience from what I did see in previous seasons of the show, yeah.
And how are you able to cope with that? The watching it back, is that anxiety inducing?
Oh, without a doubt.
I feel like that's quite an obvious question, but yeah.
I was absolutely terrified watching the first episode, and I'm terrified to watch the next and the next, like more after that. Like it makes me feel on edge, because you're sort of giving up your power to entertainment. And I don't think everyone really talks about this a lot, but it's really terrifying having someone else take control of how other people will perceive you, because we're not in charge of the editing. We don't know how because an edit of like a comment or a face can change everyone's perception about you. And then that comes with a whole barrage of hate or love. So it has been a bit terrifying watching so far, the one.
Well, we think you did brilliantly. We loved it.
Thank you.
but you know, you're right, you've got that context, because for the listeners, if they're not familiar with the show, you know, you're doing these challenges, you're going in and out of drag for different parts of it, and it's so much content. So you might be doing an episode in a few days, but we only see an hour of it. And so it's fascinating for me to hear you talk about it, partly because of how I am. I love long form. I love podcasting. So the idea of trying to talk about mental health in a way that then would be edited down to like 2 minutes is quite terrifying to me.
Yeah, it is. It really is, because we know conversations about mental health can go any which way. And a lot of them aren't always appropriate for TV sometimes. But I think it's really important to have those long conversations. And that's why I love podcasts, and I love sitting down and having conversations with people, because you really get to know the person and you get to like have that open dialogue. Whereas you don't get that on reality TV all the time.
Well, you're right. It's only snapshots. And was there any things you did to support yourself and your mental health through the process that you'd recommend? Or just the pandemic in general?
To be honest, just what really helped me during the pandemic was that I became a lot more spiritual. I always used to teach mindfulness, but I never actually practiced it myself. But I do it every day.
Which
now.
Is many mental health professionals are like that.
Yeah. We always do things like, I used to do CBT and I was always like, this will never work on me. But I think about it and I'm like, yeah, probably I would like to go for that actually. But I do mindfulness every day now. And I've really got into yoga, and I read a really good book the other day. It was called The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it was about the law of attraction and things like that, and just being like open with your mind, and you give out positive energy, that's what you'll receive back. And I really do believe that. But yeah, I've become a lot more spiritual during the pandemic.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do love that. I think the way The Secret kind of gets lost on a lot of people is because it can be very vague the way it's described, and very, you know, I think it's trying not to be denominational. So rather than talking about religion, they're talking about like the universe. But I think it can kind of alienate a lot of people, whereas actually at its core message, a lot of it is just, you know, what you put out, you will receive back. So if you're, you know, a friendly person, funnily enough, people are more likely to be friendly to you. When you break it down like that, you can see how it really applies.
Exactly. And it's just about being open as well. That's why I think during the pandemic, I've become a lot more open with myself. And I actually do talk about my feelings a little bit more now and what I've been through, whereas I would never have even dreamed about it beforehand. And I do feel like a different person for it.
And I'm sure you're probably already aware of this, but I would imagine from the work that you've done and now getting on a show that people connect so deeply with, you are probably going to have a lot of experience of touring and people just kind of word vomiting their mental health stories on you. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I never even used to tell people that I was a mental health nurse when I first started drag. But when I was in a club and people would get drunk, they would always come up to the drag queens and tell them the life story. I can't imagine doing it now.
Oh, so you had it already then? Nothing changes?
Yeah. But it was very like lighthearted conversation. But I would love to do like talks and things and tour with that, because I think it'd be really interesting.
Yeah. And I think there's so much we can learn from it. You know, once you start breaking down narrow ideas of gender, you can start to break down all sorts, because there's these sort of stereotypes in everything. And also, I think that extends to mental health. You know, you can talk about it in a way where it's like, okay, well, I thought I knew what a mental health professional looked like, and you've now blown my mind.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people, when I used to say to them in the clubs, oh, have you like spoken to anyone about this? Do you not want to talk to your doctor? And they're like, no, I wouldn't dream of it. I'd rather just come here and get drunk and talk to you. And it is just about breaking down that we are just all people, like just try and open up, and it will help you accept yourself a lot more.
And do you feel like that's something that specifically within gay communities that becomes an outlet, like going to the club, because it's a designated safe space in a way that the rest of the world cannot feel?
Yeah, without a doubt. When I first discovered the drag scene, I started doing drag. Like, I would do nursing, and it was like very stressful and very strenuous. And I would never talk about myself, and it would always be about everyone else. So my outlet, instead of talking about my feelings, I would go to a club and just get drunk all the time. That was my outlet then. And looking back, I know that that was quite an unhealthy period of my life, but that was how I used to deal with things. I can go to a club now. Well, before the pandemic, I was in the club and I would do a full performance and do like chats and everything with everyone. And I was completely stone cold sober, but I never used to be able to do that. So it does take time But I do think quite a few people get not lost, but trapped in that cycle. And I think it's really important to try and help people be aware of that.
And I think you are definitely a part of that. You know, having more role models embedded in communities that people can look up to. And so, yeah, I'm excited to see what you do, obviously in terms of drag, but also in terms of, you know, talking about mental health. And yeah, I absolutely want to go to see you do a show and then go see you do a talk afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. Because there's no rules as well. Like, there is no rules to what we can do. If people see a drag queen, we don't always have to just flip around on stage. We can do other things as well, same as anyone.
I think you look stunning talking or dancing, so you have that advantage.
Thank you very much.
So if people aren't already aware of Drag Race, maybe they've never watched it before, why should they go and see you?
If people have never seen Drag Race before, I would just say give it a go, because it will probably open your mind to a lot of things, even if you don't know what a drag queen is. Or yeah, it makes you think about a lot of things, and I think it makes you question your own beliefs as well. And I know it's just a reality TV show, but it's an absolute fabulous platform, and it really does start a lot of really important conversations.
Yeah, very well said. And I agree, it's people do find it very empowering. And I think particularly here in the UK, when there's such a history of like pantomime style drag and drag being embedded in our culture in a way that I think sometimes people even forget, you know, like the amount of people that think they've never seen a drag queen perform, but they've gone to the panto. Or, you know, we look back at Shakespeare's time and women weren't allowed on stage. So, of course, there were men in women's clothing. So I guess it's, you know, it's as much British culture as it's anything else.
Exactly, it is. And it's a culture that's incredible.
Agreed. And so go support our queen, Cherry Valentine. If you are a fan of the colours red and black, you will not be disappointed. Oh, and you have, even if people just watch the entrance, you have a fun entrance.
See, I didn't even know that they were going to keep that in. They told me, no, we'll cut that out.
And hopefully we're not ruining it for people, but your headpiece almost comes off because you're just too tall for the door.
Yeah, well, I didn't even clock the door. I was like, it'll be fine. There's loads of room there. Next thing you know, where's the bobby pins?
Which, to be fair, does feel a bit rude, because I'm like, when RuPaul, who's like 6'4", is hosting it, you'd think they would have figured out the door sizes. But I mean, he has his own door, so maybe.
It's entertainment. People are telling me that it makes me more relatable, so I'm just going to go with that.
I mean, Miranda has made a lot of money on being people's clumsy ally. So yeah, it's a whole world of comedy for you there.
Exactly.
Grand. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely catching up. Obviously, we wish you the best. You know more than we do what's happening, and good luck watching it back.
And it's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.